The Last Word with Matt Cooper. Weekdays from 4:30. Today
FM. Absolutely delighted for today's Culture Club to be joined by Gar Garvey from Elbow. Guy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I'm very happy to be here.
10th studio album, Audio Vertigo. Is it still as much of a thrill when you get to your 10th album to actually having written all the songs, recorded it, produced it, engineered it, to actually get the finished product out to people?
It is. I got my first vinyl copy of this record in my hand last week. It was my 50th birthday on Wednesday.
Happy birthday.
Thank you very much. Yeah, so to get hold of our 10th album, to be holding it in my hand on the 50th, I was very, very happy.
And actually with the physical album itself, in the streaming era, to have actual physical copies. Yeah. And you probably grew up in the era where you loved buying albums, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. Well, I was sort of that age group that vinyl was £1 or £2 tops.
Yeah.
Because it was all secondhand and everybody was buying CD. So, yeah, you could hit the market with 20 quid and come back with tons of music. And yes, I've still got my vinyl collection and that's still a record to me.
And of course, that shows in all of your music, the enormous range of influences and music theory that you've listened to. So how would you describe the influences for Audio Vertigo? Is it different from other Elbow albums?
Well, it's all of our influences. Craig is definitely into beats. Craig's never really had a record collection. He's been with his wife, Esther, since we were kids. And she buys music and she keeps up on things and he hears it by proxy. But what Craig chooses to listen to is stuff he can dance to. That's, you know. So that's more and more finding its way into our work. On top of that, me and Mark and Al, our drummer, and Pete as well, actually, have a real love of sort of blues rock. It's got to be very specifically of an era, you know.
Sort which era?
Cream, Hendrix, you know, that sort of classic era. As soon as it's about the penis, it's like, not for me, you know. Rock needs to steer around that. I'd rather it was about purple flying wolfhounds than the penis. Then it's all the stuff we discovered together because we've been together for 33 years. So it's like DJ Shadow finding its way in there. And then the lyricists I love. Tom Waits, perhaps more than any other album that I've done because I'm writing a lot in character on this record.
Explain that. What do you mean by writing a lot in character?
So they've always, my songs have always been quite autobiographical.
Yeah.
And if I've dropped into a character, it's on behalf of somebody I've met. And the last one, which was written through a very difficult period of, you know, in lockdown during COVID, but my mother-in-law, the late great Diana Rigg, died in our house of cancer.
Oh.
So of an evening, had Diana, my wife, and my little son, who's six, so he was three. When they went to bed, you'd got through a day. And I'd go to the back door and I'd open my emails and there'd be a new piece of music from the boys. And it was literally a life raft. It was like, it, you know. And the whole thing was written on my bin outside my back door, chain smoking. So it's very autobiographical. It's a lot about my childhood. It's a lot about Bury, Lancashire, where we all grew up. And it's a lot about my son. And it's a lot about Diana. And it's all true to life and very, very carefully woven.
How important is it to you to continue doing new material like this rather than resting on your laurels for the work that you might have done 10 or 15 years ago, which was such a massive hit and so celebrated and which is still played so regularly by people?
We haven't stopped. We stopped after our first album and the second album was annoyingly cliched in how difficult it was. And even though I'm very proud of the record, and we all are, we noticed a few years ago we never play anything off it. And it's because we remember the process being awful. So we've never stopped since then. It's something, it's what we do.
Let's go to the Culture Club choices. And I want to start with, you've got a great choice, which a number of people who've done this section have also nominated as the first single that they remember buying.
Oh, really?
They have, yeah. It is a great track, yeah. Ultravox's Vienna.
Yeah.
What attracted you to it at the time?
I remember my brother and I would act out the video. So from what I remember of the video, I've not seen it for decades. There was a lot of dimly lit alleyways.
Yes, very dark.
Yeah, wet cobblestone.
Yes.
And then during the energetic middle eight, there's a flight down some stairs, somebody running from somebody down some stairs, and we'd act that out. And I think, like everybody who loved that song, it was the drama. It was like a little mini opera in a song.
But you're obviously the MTV era to an extent, and so you were attracted to songs as much by the videos in that stage, were you?
I think it was the story. I think the video helped with this story. I'm not sure what the story is, but...
Well, let's hear a little bit, remind ourselves, it's a tremendous track, Ultravox, Midjour, Vienna. Brilliantly, hasn't it, from 1980?
It really has. I was just thinking, it sounds like there's a real church organ in there.
Does it? I wouldn't know.
So. Yeah, just coming up there in the choruses.
And Mitchell had such a varied career. He at one stage played with Thin Lizzy as well, a big friend of Phil Lynott. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I'll tell you a nice story. I was on the last version of Feed the World.
Which, of course, he co-wrote with Bob Geldof, didn't he?
Right. So... As we were leaving, my manager was there, and as we were leaving, Phil, very uncharacteristically, we were talking to Midge and Bob, and he said, Bob, I never do this, but the first single I ever bought was Boomtown Rats, Tell Me Why I Don't Like Mondays. And I was like, well, if we're playing that game, Midge, my first single was Oh Vienna, like that. Geldof said, Oh Vienna, I shit it. And Midge went, tell me why you don't like good songs.
And did the role continue?
No, I was like, have you said that before, you two? You know, but no, they're bloody good crack, those two.
Okay, favourite album? I'm delighted you managed to narrow it down to one, because nearly every musician and even lots of other people we bring into Culture Club say it's impossible to nominate a favourite album. Tell us why you've gone for a great band, Talk Talk, and their album Laughingstock.
So Talk Talk, I came to, as probably most people did, through Colour of Spring, yeah, which had Life's What You Make It, I think.
Yes.
And it had Living in Another World and amazing, big, ambitious pop songs. The weirdest tune on the record was a little thing, I think it's called April the 5th. And I remember thinking, what is that? That's odd. And of course it became my favourite moment on the record, which is an argument for the album. You can only do that if you've got an album of people's attention.
Yeah.
And then they just did the most incredible, experimental, timeless, beautiful piece in Spirit of Eden. And I found out years later, because I could never fathom how it was written. It was just so patient and subtle and beautiful. And the fact that there was the natural world on the cover of both these records, it was the most organic music I'd ever heard. And unknown to me at that time, it was digital recording. They knew they could put the breath of one instrument onto the tail of another, and they could shift the arrangements round. And Hollis was obsessed with the first sound that Sessions musicians made, in a kind of catch-the-moment, you know, kind of thing. And then by the time they did Laughing Stock, they knew their palette, they knew what they had to play with, and they used the tools to create brand new songs with authority. I know why they stopped after that. Nowhere left to go.
Let's hear from the album Laughing Stock, Talk Talk. Here's the track Ascension Day. Timeless music, Guy, isn't it? I mean, it's more than 30 years old and it still feels utterly fresh.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's so beautiful.
Yeah.
And the you know, just at the end there, just before we faded, he sings the word double. Double deal is the phrase. And he's tracked the word double between him saying it twice. So the duh is one take and the bull is another. Just to emphasise the symmetry of that word, double. It's from two different takes, and it's full of that level of nuance.
And do you work as hard as that in studio with your material?
Yes. Luckily, in Craig, our producer, who's Mark's brother and the keyboardist in the band, you have someone who is tireless where detail is concerned. And, I mean, all that music is a lot of decisions. And we agonise over every single one.
How difficult then is it to reproduce that in live performance, or do you do something different in live performance?
We decide on what the essentials are. And I won't lie, we use backing track here and there.
Yeah.
You'll never hear something at a show that isn't at least represented on stage. So if you hear a string section, it's predominantly the people on stage, but we might double it with a recording. And if we can, we'll double it with a recording of them. So there's an honesty to it. A song like Grounds for Divorce requires two drum kits, and there's no way we're bringing on a whole drum kit and another drummer. One drummer's enough. So we'll have that doubled. But there's all sorts of things.
This is those who are lucky enough to have tickets to see you in Trinity on the 1st of July will be able to enjoy that.
I can't wait for that.
Okay, and then for a favourite band of artists, you've nominated Joni Mitchell. Tell us why.
I grew up with Joni Mitchell's music. All my five sisters love Joni Mitchell. They all have very, very different tastes in music, but they all love her. And she's such a part, her music's such a part of my life that I've gone from seeing her as an auntie, a fun auntie, and then one of my sisters, because, I mean, when I listen to Bar and Grill, for instance, I hear my five sisters singing it in harmony. And her stuff's fun to learn because of how wordy and busy it is and because of how many images it creates. And then as I became a songwriter, I couldn't stop listening to her and I couldn't stop learning from her. And then as I get older, I listen to her younger stuff and I hear the naivety in it. So she goes to being a little sister. And before I know it, she's my mother, my auntie, my sister, my little sister, my friend, my guide. You know, she's just... And there's still a load of Joni I don't know.
There's some great stuff even from the mid-80s, like the Dog Eat Dog album. I love that album.
Yeah.
It's just one of the more lesser known ones, but it's brilliant. And did you see her in the Grammys recently when they did the stage tribute tour?
No.
And she was sitting there, and she's 80, I think, now, and she's had ill health, but she was there and she sang. It was the best moment of the Grammys by a mile.
I'll have to check that out.
Let's have a listen to, from the classic album Blue, a little bit of Case of You.
Star, and I said, constantly in the darkness, where's that at? If you want me, I'll be in the bar. On the back of a cartoon coaster, in the blue TV screen light, I drew a map of Canada.
Earlier, and we would have heard Guy Garvey duetting with Joni Mitchell.
My best friend Peter Jobson, who was the bass player in I Am Clute, whenever he hears that song, and I always forget he's going to do it, he says, I could drink a crate of you.
For the complete the music section of the Culture Club, best gig that you were at. I presume, even though you play many gigs, do you still get to go and see other gigs?
Yeah, I'm one of those people who travels for them. I went to see Beirut's only shows in Berlin about 3-4 weeks ago, because they're the only shows that he's doing. Touring and nearly killed him, so he's done a new beautiful record. It's really something else, but he only did 3 shows, so I went to Berlin for one recently. Yeah.
But the choice you have goes back to us at 1991, Chilov and Special Sauce at the Manchester Roadhouse.
So Chilov and Special Sauce are this kind of blues jazz hip hop combo from Philadelphia, and they use sort of old jazz ethics to record the music, or they did on the first record. So you can hear a very live room, a great double bass player and drummer. And then you've got this really cocky Philadelphia cat who plays harmonica and steel guitar and raps. So it's a real mishmash. But it was just the age I was, 2021, me and my friends loved it. And we couldn't believe he was coming to town. And there was only another 200 or 300 kids there. And he came out into the crowd and he kissed my friend Anna and all this stuff. It was my first rock star experience, and he was effortlessly cool.
We've got a little bit of the 11-minute performance of Baby's Got Sauce.
Wonderful.
Cooling out, waiting for my leg. She got the special sauce, that's what she's my baby. And of course I do anything for her, anything she wanna show her, honey. The sharp knife for sharp tongue. Gimme some, but don't take the time. Gimme none. You got to work and deserve it. Earn it to own it. And once you got it, never ever gonna leave it alone. Don't take my screen, no fool. Never been stood up. Oh, she does the stepping in my baby's got song. Your baby ain't sweet like mine. Sweet, take it, baby, that's some funky lemonade you got. Go with big tea, is it special for me? Did you make it today? Cause I always stop by if you like me too.
Okay, that's my first time hearing G-Love and Special Sauce. It might be for a lot of our listeners as well. Guy Garvey of Elbow is with us for the Culture Club. We have lots more to talk to him about when we come back after this. Welcome back. Guy Garvey from Elbow is our guest on the Culture Club today. So we're going to move away from the music for a little while and tell us about, we asked favourite movie, actor and director, and you decided to stay close to home to make your choice.
So my favourite actor is, of course, my wife, Rachel Sterling. I have to say that.
She's a stage actor mainly, is she?
She's a theatre creature for sure.
Yeah.
But she's her notable tellies. She was in a brilliant thing called Capital with Toby Jones. Also with Toby Jones in the series Detectorists. She plays Mackenzie's wife in that. And various movies down the years. But yeah,
she was in Master and Commander, I believe, as well.
No, that's my favourite movie. She's
that's
favorite
your favourite movie. Sorry.
Yeah,
I got the mistake there in that.
There's no women in Master and Commander.
That's Russell Crowe movie, is it?
That's right.
Okay.
I'm not a huge fan of The Crow, really, but that movie's amazing.
Okay. Well, we'll come back to Rachel because we actually have a clip from The Detectorists with Mackenzie Crook.
Great.
So tell me what it's like.
No, I want to know your first impression. But you have to imagine what it could be, so don't look at the holes in the roof or the broken windows.
So my second impression?
Yeah, I want to know your second impression.
How can we afford a house?
It's an auction and there's no reserve, so we just take what we've got and bid what we could afford.
We haven't got anything.
We've got some savings.
Andy, we've got 10 grand that buys a deposit on a flat, not a three-bedroom cottage and half an acre of land.
Well, if you don't try, we'll never know.
You're a dreamer.
You may say I'm a dreamer. I'm not the only one. I hope someday...
I get it.
Imagine.
Oh, Andy, what have you fallen in love with?
It's beautiful, isn't it? I mean, it could be.
Who's going to do the work? You?
Yeah.
Single-handed?
Single-handed, baby. That's what I want to do. I'll be a full-time hobbyist. I'll take Stan to school, I'll pick him up, and in between, I'll build us a house with roses around the door.
You haven't seen me so enthused since we got back from Africa. So what? You give up archaeology?
Yeah, for a couple of years, I would. Now I have time to fix the shingles, I'll have time to fix the door, I'll have time to oil the hinges, and to mend the window.
Shut up, I get it. Go and find Stan. There could be bear traps or a hidden well.
I pay extra for a hidden well.
You're enjoying listening to that almost as much as you enjoyed Joni Mitchell.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, so Mackenzie's on-screen wife and mother-in-law are my actual on-screen wife and mother-in-law, yeah. Rachel's mum was Diana Rigg.
Famous for the Avengers, wasn't it?
That's right. And she was also the Queen of Thorns in Game of Thrones. And, yeah, she was quite a woman. But I have lovely memories of that particular... That season of Detectorist, because my son Jack was 2-3 months old, and we filmed it all around Framlingham in the West Country, which is a beautiful spot. And it was a really hot summer. And the base for the filming unit was an old airbase. And the guy that ran it bought decommissioned Cold War jets. And we asked for a special dressing room on account of the new baby and the old mother-in-law. And long story short, I found myself rocking a 2-month-old baby in this clapped-out caravan with 16 rusting Tornado jets out the window and Dame Diana Rigg snoring opposite me. And the words went through my mind, how did I get here?
Lovely memory to have, though. Did you spend a lot of time as a family? Do you go when Rachel is acting and various things, maybe move away from music for a while, do you?
If we possibly can, yeah. So her first job after that was in Vancouver for 3 months, and we decamped and did that, although I didn't like Vancouver.
Why not?
Because there's nothing to like unless you like hiking. And I don't.
You can listen to plenty of music. Tell us, if we move on to plays and theatre and the rest of it, give us a favourite there.
Theatre?
Yeah, or musicals or plays, whatever.
Well, through Rachel's friendship with Mackenzie Crook, who we heard there,
yeah.
He was in Jerusalem with Mark Rylance. And 10 years after it had blown everybody away, they came back and did it again, and I was lucky enough to get a ticket. And it was just the most amazing thing I've ever seen on a stage.
Why is that? Well, tell us about it.
So, in brief, it's a snapshot of all the hypocrisies of Great Britain. It's a man living in a wood in an Airstream caravan who everybody buys their drugs off. Everybody from the local teenagers to the professor at the university. And he's called Rooster. And he's part traveller. And Mark Rylance plays him. It opens with two people slapping an eviction notice on his caravan. You occasionally see his head pop out the roof with a tin helmet on and this kind of thing. Then when they're gone, he leaps from this Airstream caravan and there's a trough of water front of the stage. And in one bound, he does a handstand and lowers himself into the water and then he pushes himself back to his feet, covering the front row in water. And here you have the most amazing character. That's before he said a word. And it's beautiful and magical and terrifying. And just the way it was staged and the cast and the script, it was just astonishing.
Let's hear a brief scene from it.
Account of the fact that he's in the Barbados this week with Kate Moss. His faithful hound, a Shep, hereby inform Kennet and Avon Council and all that sorry of the new estate, Rooster Johnny Byron ain't going nowhere. So a happy St. George's Day. Now kiss my beggar arse, you Puritans!
Okay, that sounds absolutely intriguing. Okay, we asked your famous book, or favourite book or author, and you've gone for the poet Seamus Heaney.
I love Seamus. I think, I know everybody considers him their father, but I think he's actually mine.
Okay, why is that?
Well, I mean, he's just the most fluent writer. It's like he has... a massive classical knowledge at his fingertips, which he'll draw on unselfconsciously, and in the same line, he'll make up a word because it does the job better. And you're just with him in every memory and trust him implicitly in his worldview and his moral compass and his love of people and things and his mischief and his romance and his massive, great big heart and brain.
Let's hear him reading his poem, Blackberry Picking.
Beautiful.
Late August, given heavy rain and sun for a full week, the blackberries would ripen. At first, just one, a glossy purple clot, among others, red, green, hard as a nut. You ate that first one, and its flesh was sweet like thickened wine. Summer's blood was in it, leaving stains upon the tongue and lust for picking. Then red ones inked up, and that hunger sent us out with milk cans, pea tins, jam pots, where briars scratched and wet grass bleached our boots. Round hay fields, cornfields and potato drills, we trekked and picked until the cans were full, until the tinkling bottom had been covered with green ones, and on top, big dark blobs burned like a plate of eyes. Our hands were peppered with thorn pricks, our palms sticky as bluebeards. We hoarded the fresh berries in the byre, but when the bath was filled, we found a fur, a rat-grey fungus, glutting on our cash. The juice was stinking too. Once off the bush, the fruit fermented. The sweet flesh would turn sour. I always felt like crying. It wasn't fair that all the lovely canfuls smelt of rot. Each year, I hoped they'd keep. Knew they would not.
Seamus Heaney, Blackberry Picking, and Guy Garvey, that is just beautifully read as well, isn't it?
Isn't recording a miracle?
Explain why.
That we can hear him read those words.
Okay, tell us about favourite television.
what did I put? Yes, Cold War spy novels, particularly Le Carré, plus Alec Guinness gives us Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy and Smiley's People. I urge everybody to watch them, particularly if you're 50 or older, because as well as being a masterclass in acting from Alec Guinness, they are also from a time where There's one scene where he's reading a file and smoking a cigarette. There's no dramatic music. It's a locked-off shot. And then suddenly he puts his chin in his palm, intrigued by something he's found. No dramatic music, no change in lighting, and your heart's beating out of your chest because he's found something. It's that subtle. And I think drama that subtle, television drama of that era, credits the viewer with intelligence and intuition. So it's richer than anything that's been made since. And it's such great writing. So great writing, great actor, and also a snapshot of a world gone. It's full of Ford Cortinas and Capris and big collars.
Last thing I want to ask you about Guy Garvey is what we call a buried treasure, a song, a band, painting, podcast, book, movie, anything you think people should know more about. And you wanted to tell us about The Words to Cactus, written by Black Francis.
So, a lifelong Pixies fan, or at least since I heard them when I was 13, and this life has found me in a caravan with Dame Rig, looking at Cold War jets, and my little boy. It's also, it's sent me all over the world. I've met a lot of my heroes, including I did a gig in Lynchburg, Tennessee, paid for by a big whiskey company that doesn't need any more promotion from me, and they assembled a band from Muscle Shoals, from the old house band, and me, Richard Hawley, and Frank Black from the Pixies did our own songs and cover versions with Spooner Oldham and all these old guys. And I couldn't talk. I was so nervous when I met Charles, he's Frank Black's real name. And I was so nervous I had to sort of say hi and walk away. And then he came back and he said, "Dear Guy, my wife would never forgive me if I didn't have a photograph taken with the lead singer of the Elbows." And I thought, "You beautiful gentleman liar." And then he said, "Would you do me the honour of duetting with me on a Pixies song tonight?" And I was like, "Yeah." And we did Cactus, but I realised during the sound check that I would forget the words because of the enormity of the privilege. So he wrote them out for me, and I had them on a music stand, and somebody swiped them.
Oh.
So I have the experience, but I don't have the memento.
Well, actually, there's one other thing you actually wanted to mention, and we'll play out in this. And thank you so much, Guy Garvey from Elbow, for joining us here in the Culture Club. And we're all looking forward to Audio Vertigo, the new album, which is coming out now, and to seeing you in Trinity, those who are lucky enough to have tickets on the 1st of July. But you want to finish with Nadine Shah.
Nadine is a friend of mine, and I've watched her develop as an artist over the past 15 years. And she's reaching new depths in her lyrics. She's had a crazy few years. She's had a pretty dark time. Her co-writer, Ben Hillier, is how I got to know her in the first place. And he's produced everyone from Blur to Depeche Mode. And he did Elbow's first two records. In fact, those were his first jobs as a producer. And he's stuck with it, and he's stuck with her, and she's found herself in this place where a lot of artists would like to be. Her work is inseparable from her character. It's cost her a load, and suddenly it's not, but she's in the jet stream. It's the most amazing work, and to see her live, it's unforgettable.
That's a very generous thing of you to finish out with. And we're going to finish from the new album by Nadine Shah, Filthy Underneath, with Even Light. But Guy Garvey of Elbow, thank you so much for joining us for the Culture.
My pleasure. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Last Word with Matt Cooper. Weekdays from 4:30. Today.